This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thanks for joining us today. We begin this week's show by listening to my conversation with Golden Globe award-winning actress Kathleen Turner. She's best known for her roles in Body Heat, Romancing the Stone, Serial Mom, and Peggy Sue Got Married. On February 29th, Turner will engage in an onstage interview as part of the Philadelphia Theater Company's Master Series. And in March, she can be seen on a new Hulu series called Path. She joined me in the studio back in 2010 when she was in town to perform her one-woman show, Red Hot Patriot, the kick-ass wit of Molly Ivins, about the colorful Texas columnist who challenged the male-dominated world of politics. Let's listen. I know, I don't know if you still teach, but I was looking at your memoir, Send Yourself Roses, that you did or do teach an acting class, practical acting, Shut Up and Do It.
Yes, they have to put that into perspective, yes.
But that's your approach, which is what, stop thinking?
No, not at all. No, not at all. I just don't believe in sitting around and talking about acting.
Oh, interesting.
It makes no sense to me. So when I teach, I get two-hour sessions. And I have about 16 students because I found within that time limit, that's about as many as I can get on their feet every class. So no one just sits and watches or talks. That you have to practice acting. You have to be on your feet. You have to do it.
And is that what you do? I mean, even for yourself?
Absolutely. The minute I can get on my feet, I do.
Right. And I know that you're about to premiere this Molly Ivins play, and I'm just wondering about that feeling before a performance or before the start of a performance, sort of where you are in your head.
Well, usually I can't wait. I mean, all I want to do is get out there. You know, like come on. Isn't it 8 o'clock yet? You know, let's go. Get the people in their seats. You know, because I know that once I'm out there, I can do things. I can fix something, or I can, you know, drive it in such a way that I can turn it into the direction I need. You know, it's the helplessness of being off stage and not being able to do anything yet that makes me so itchy.
Oh, that's interesting. So you have to sort of figure out how to fill that downtime in a way? Which is hard, I get
the
feeling.
Yes, it's hard.
Then I do want to play a scene from Peggy Sue Got Married, and you did get that Oscar nomination for this role. This is 1986, and Nicolas Cage is Charlie Bodell. He's your future husband, high school boyfriend, and the character that you play, Peggy Sue, mysteriously is sent back in time as an adult in a teenager's body, and in this scene, Charlie doesn't know it. Let's listen.
Peggy Sue, will you marry me?
How can you know what I've been going through? And of course I'm scared. I can't change anything. I can't
You're
help anybody. I couldn't
me.
Even help
I'm
my
I'm proposing
friends.
To you now.
You betrayed me. You were never there for me and the children.
I'll be there for the children. Forget Walter. Forget the group. I want to marry you. Don't be crazy.
I may be crazy, but I'm not crazy enough to marry you twice.
I'm looking at you, listening to that scene. Is there anything you want to say, Kathleen Turner?
Oh, I just didn't like Nicholas's choice of the voice he used there.
Well, I don't think you liked Nicholas at all, did you?
Well, he was difficult to work with, I will confess. You know, I think a lot of it was that he was very, very young, and he was Coppola's nephew. And I think it was terribly important to him that it not appear that he got the role because of nepotism. And so he was trying to distinguish himself from Francis every way he could. And that was got in the way a little bit, I think, over the acting.
Were you surprised to get a nomination?
I hoped for it. I did hope for it. I loved the movie. And God loves it. I mean, I worked so hard on it. She really is in every scene, you know, and we had a real time barrier we were up against. So, yeah, I know I hoped for it.
I mean, it's a great performance, and we were talking actually on the air, or before we went on the air, about having fun as an actor. I mean, that's sort of when you're having fun, then you know you've got it, right? You've got the part, or you feel the part.
I have fun, period. Yeah. I do. I mean, I'm not always the best judge of whether or not, but if I'm not enjoying it, then, gosh, I don't know what I'd do.
You were also telling me that you don't like playing roles of victims. I mean, that you're attracted. Well, is it because it just isn't interesting enough?
Or? I don't think it's very interesting. I mean, I to play women who try and fail is one thing. That's fine. Yeah. But to play a woman who sits and waits for a man to come along and solve her situation is just boring to me.
Well, I want to play another scene, and this is from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And I do think it's one of the best movie lines ever that you deliver. You're this animated femme fatale, Jessica Rabbit, and in this scene visiting Private Detective Eddie Valiant, played by Bob Hoskins, and this takes place in his office. Let's listen.
You've got the wrong idea about me, Mr. Valiant. I'm a pawn in this, just like Roger. Can you help me find him? Just name your price, and I'll pay it.
Yeah, I bet you would. You gotta have the rabbit to make the scam work.
No, 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 I love my husband. You've got me all wrong. You don't know how hard it is being a woman looking the way I do.
Yeah, well, you don't know how hard it is being a man looking at a woman looking the way you do.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
I can't get enough of that.
I know, I love
so
that
great,
line.
Isn't it? Was it fun to do the voice? I mean, just to play the voice of a character like that?
It was, because also at the same time, I was 8 months pregnant.
Oh, were you?
Oh, yeah. So I'd waddle into the studio, you know, and it was just wonderful to get that job, you know. You know, at that time. And in fact, my very last session, I went into labor and I had
this, can you hear it in your voice?
No, I wasn't recording. I was on my way to work and I said, take me to NYU Hospital and I'm in the prep room going, call the studio, I won't be in today.
Sounds a little bit like Molly Ivins, right?
Yeah.
I know for older actresses, there's always, and I don't think it's just for actresses, I think it's for older women in general, there's that question about, do you have a little plastic surgery? You know, what are you going to do to keep your appearance up? Is that something that you have thought about, you struggle with, you debate about?
I do. I'm not against it per se, although I did slip in the snow about 5 weeks ago and cut my lip, you know, and so I had some stitches in it. And when I was there, this very nice man, a plastic surgeon, said, oh, let me do your forehead. And I was like, no, wait a minute, I earned these wrinkles, okay? You know, they mean something to me. No. I think as an actor, it's important that I have age and experience on my face.
Mm-hmm. You do have rheumatoid arthritis, as we were mentioning earlier, and in your book, you write that once you got diagnosed, and obviously it's a very painful thing, you said, I felt quite worthless. It really didn't matter what I said. I felt I had no voice. I'd lost my power to set the course of my life. The kind of helplessness when something is as chronic and painful as that takes over.
Well, also, I've always been an extremely physical woman. And losing that entirely, I mean, wondering if I can walk 5 steps, you know, to get to the bathroom or something, it was devastating. So much of my self-image and my confidence came from my physical strength and my agility. So when that was completely taken away, I did not know what I had left, you know, and becoming so terribly dependent on my poor husband.
Yeah.
And even my daughter, who was, at that time, she was about 4, I guess, when it really, really hit. And 4, 4 and a half. And little things like I was sitting in the bathroom and I was trying to squeeze some moisturizing lotion. And I couldn't get my hands to work to squeeze this soft plastic bottle. And I was crying and sobbing. I mean, she, poor thing, she came by and she said, Mommy, you know, Mommy, what's wrong? I said, I can't get the moisturizer out. And she went, oh, give it to me. And she just squirted it all up and down my body, which, of course, made me laugh. Mm-hmm. But, it was such a... It was terrible to be so helpless, yes.
Well, I do want to play another clip, and this is from Californication. It's it's from Showtime, and maybe even before I play it, you play this woman, Sue Collini. How would you describe her?
Okay, I would describe her as a nymphomaniacal sociopathic agent.
That's a better setup than I could do. Well, here's a scene where your character, Sue Collini, is in her office with Charlie Runkel. He's played by Evan Handler, and he's a former employee, and you're offering him a career opportunity of a lifetime. Let's listen.
My memoir.
Wow. I would love to read it sometime.
Oh, I want you to read it. And then I want you to sell it. That's right, Runkel. I want you to be my agent.
What are you talking about, Sue? You fired me.
Look, Runkel, whether you know it or not, you're a maverick, a renegade. You beat off to the march of your own drummer. That's the kind of agent I want. It's the kind of agent I've always tried to be. And in the meantime, you can take me.
Oh, okay. I see where this is going. You're dangling your memoirs, which I know I can sell the shit out of, by the way, as an excuse to continue our torrid little affair.
Mm-hmm. I don't see why the two cannot peacefully coexist.
Is that a fun part for you, Sue Collini?
It was fun, and I really enjoyed the people that I worked with there, but it was very embarrassing to me. I mean, I was always, honest to gosh, I was blushing half the time and just... I only balked at one thing that I cannot obviously even describe. Right. You know, I went to the writer Tom and I said, I can't do it. I just can't do that. And he went, Okay, it's all right then. But oh my.
I think and that was a very clean up version.
This is the furthest character from me I think I've ever played.
So why did you choose the role? Obviously, you knew what you were getting.
Well, I've never done one like that. You know, I mean, it's like doing that Friends. You know, when I'm playing it's a woman playing a man playing a woman. Now, yeah. I've never done that, so it's attractive.
So, does acting ever get stale for you?
Not yet.
Well, it's been a long time, right?
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, it is such an extraordinary rush, performance energy, and it's almost a drug, I guess, you know?
That was my 2010 interview with actress Kathleen Turner. She can be seen in an onstage interview as part of the Philadelphia Theater Company's 2016 Theater Master Series on February 29th, and she's starring in an upcoming Hulu series called Path. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from performance artist Karen Finley. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Karen Finley is no stranger to controversy. As a performance artist, she pushed the boundaries to such an extent that she had her National Endowment of the Arts grants revoked by the Supreme Court. Beyond her stage performances, she's also an avant-garde author. A 25th anniversary edition of her first and most acclaimed work, Shock Treatment, has just been released. She joined me for a conversation in 2002 when she was in town to perform at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Let's take a listen. What do you enjoy about solo performing, having that stage to yourself?
Well, yes, I will have to admit that I have a psychological need to be recognized.
And you've done that.
And I've had all my unmet needs satisfied on stage.
People looking at you?
Yes. I mean, I think... Or maybe not looking at my idealized self, or probably looking at my martyrdom, which, I mean, I think that, I will admit that there, you know, is an exhibitionistic quality to much of my work, which is then has provoked so much fury for a cultural Rorschach. I really have become a Rorschach test for the nation, and many people have... project their own fears and anxieties onto me when I present this female body on stage.
Well, there is something, obviously, and you've been the brunt of it, there is something so powerful and I think scary for a lot of people about the female body, which has been, again, so much a part of what you've done. I mean, you don't get naked in this show at the Fringe Festival, but at the same time, one is very aware of your body and how you move and how you dress and how you sit and how you turn your head. It's very much a part of your presentation.
I don't always get naked in my work.
You think that disappoints your audience sometimes?
Well, I mean, I think sometimes when one has sex, they can have great sex without having to always take their clothes off, too. So, you know, I just didn't seem like that had to do with this show, although there is erotic elements about it. I have the idea of segues of some fantasies, which is just the idea of that trying to get back to normal and wanting to have fantasy or having some type of even terrorist sex. And I think that was happening in the culture right after 9/11. I mean, it's a lot of women. We would go down to Ground Zero and wear bikinis and dress up and just stand there waving at the men and just, that's, you know, on the internet, that's what really a lot of women would do. And
as a way of spurring them on, inspiring, cheerleading.
I think that it was just something that happened spontaneously, just in the same way that men were just leaving their trucks and just running down there. I mean, thousands of men from all over were just coming to that area to help out. They just stopped and went down. And I think there's something that was happening from a primitive level on a way, and that's just what was happening.
Mm.
And I think that there was really a sexuality that was happening there as well, that probably has to deal with the procreation, and there is a sexuality that deals with the entire hero sensibility.
The fireman, the rescue worker, the sort of hero that's been.
Yes, and I think that also there's a lot of, if you want to use the word perverted, just for a lack of a better word, you know, that enters every workplace and every tragedy.
How so?
Because I just think that tragedy, then also that sexuality has a lot to deal with that, with death, and isn't always friendly. And that there's been a lot of, you know, analysis and things go on with that, but then also just the idea of wanting to have love, maybe after all of the hate, that you want to replace it with love and beauty. And that's also very positive, of just the idea that you're going to start again and have love and beauty, and that sex and bodies that are just, it doesn't have to be, you know, sex like penetration, but the idea of just having desire, having life, having that feeling when you, it was such a beautiful day on that day, and it was just, today was that way. I mean, it's just so beautiful.
Crystal clear sky, perfect temperature.
And you feel that the year is beginning, and I think especially in all cities, you have that feeling, I'm doing my work, I am part of this wonderful city, this wonderful country, and we're working here together, and this is a day when everything is feeling like it's working. And I think everyone woke with that feeling, and I will always remember it. And I think a tragedy for me is that whenever I wake up with that feeling, I have that anxiety that comes with it.
That something's going to happen, or something could happen.
Mm-hmm.
In this process, you were, you know, sort of being grilled about your yourself, your sexual life, your habits, your expression, that all of that, in which you actually write about in this book, a different kind of intimacy.
I was grilled and looked at it in terms of my sexuality, and that could not become separate from my talents and ability. And really, in looking at it, that's just how it is. And I was upset and hurt about it because what I wanted so much, and I hope for the next generation, mm-hmm. is that there can be more of a holistic look in terms of a young woman, that her body and her talent can be combined and not looked at as that she's evil. Now, I became really actually what I was trying to fight, but that is because that's the projections. Mm. Now, Mr. Helms, in terms of humor, I realized that if I had felt this or understood this, because this happened to me because I was a naive. This happened to me when I was, in my 20s. I mean, what do you really, it takes wisdom and it takes tragedy, actually, to get you to be able to see things. And I realized that Mr. Helms was sexually abusing me within this political structure on a very public way. By taking my talents and the work that I had done and putting it on the Senate floor and saying that it was obscene, when I was doing work about Tawana Brawley, when I was doing work about rape, when I was doing work about child abuse, he was taking my work and then sexualizing it, which I don't have a problem with, sexual content material, that he forced me to make, that I had to make that decision. I think he did sexually abuse me. It was sexual harassment. And now when I see that, I think that I would have, I probably would have taken a suit to Mr. Helms, where with his federal funding that he was receiving, he was taking his time and basically sexually abusing me on my job.
Well, you even compare some of the questioning to you felt like the attorney who was questioning me of being like Roy Cohn. I felt like I was being questioned as if I were a communist during the Red Scare. He was asking you questions. Do you touch your breast when you perform? Do men look at you when you perform? You're talking about the sort of sexualization of all the questioning. I mean, these are sort of, the politics and the sexualization of it all.
Yes. Right. And actually within that, and I was pregnant at the time.
Right. About 8 months pregnant, right?
Yes. It was just an extreme situation. And I think, how do I, go and continue in doing my work? Is that I feel that I'm in a community, being here in Philadelphia, and this has been a wonderful city for me in constantly supporting my work. And I do recognize the privilege still of being an American, and that it isn't just one life, and it isn't, things just don't change in 20 years. But there has been a lot that has changed in 20 years. If you look at a lot of the more freedoms, looking at gay and lesbians, that I don't think that we have to look at artists to always be like Tennessee Williams or on television as some sidekick at a party, and that, gay and lesbians can write about gay and lesbian characters without having to always make fun of them. And that, in the case that, even in that, I think is important. Mm-hmm.
And you had mentioned your childhood, some of the difficulties of your childhood, and how your art has been a way that you've been able to, I guess, survive, make sense of some of the things that you grew up with. You also talk about the sort of generations, and you have talked about your father, his own suicide, the kinds of problems with, in his case, I guess it was some kind of manic depression within the family. Were you afraid that you had inherited some of that stuff, or do you think you have?
When I was listening to that, I just was thinking, well, it just sounds like another average American family to me.
Right. Well, even as I asked it, I felt I've asked this before.
Well, yeah. let's see, where should I, which tragedy should I start with? But I think that the point is I was brought up in a very chaotic family, and I think that, but the privilege that I was given was education, and teachers, and I was given an opportunity that I had the luxury of the imagination, and I could control within my imagination, and that is so important for all of us, that within the loss that we have, or the deprivation, that if you don't deprive the soul, and everything that you've been deprived emotionally, physically, if you can put that within the soul and change the pain to compassion, and really look at in making art, that there can feel some safety within the imagination, and then hopefully you live till you're 40 years old, and you can figure it out, and you can get a couple of days of happiness and enjoy the cup of coffee.
And you were the oldest of six kids,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And from your accent, it sounds kind of...
I'm from Chicago.
I was going to say, had to be Chicago, yeah. Certainly somewhere in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. In certain ways, you have become, or perhaps you always were, your mother's voice. Even during the break, you felt like that. In certain ways, that's what kids do for their parents, or can do for their parents, is to say things that perhaps the parents can't say.
I think that my art or my performances, I have created really a complex way of answering some of my, we say, parents' needs, or, you know, I think we all do that, so I don't think it's all necessarily that unique. But my mother, and I think her never feeling fitting in, always being looked at, who are you, what are you, the shame, the feeling, and that went in the story that went behind her, just the way how she looked. And she was so uncomfortable with this.
What did she look like?
Well, she just didn't look white. She wasn't white. She had dark skin, and
because you don't have dark
skin.
No,
my father was Irish, red hair, and you know,
I see
white. And I think probably my mother was attracted to such a white man in a way to have her children. Not to have that stigma.
Wow. How about for your brothers and sisters? Are they all light-complected? Or?
Yes, I'd say one of my brothers, but my daughter has darker skin.
Oh,
and she's constantly asked. And when she was born, they believed that my daughter had jaundice. And I had to say, no, you know, my mother is dark. And they wouldn't accept my daughter's skin color. And my daughter gets it constantly.
So the question being, what are
yes,
you?
my mother, when we would go out with her, was many times looked at as being our domestic, and many times, and but
your nanny, not your mother,
right? And when we were growing up, we lived in a mixed neighborhood, and my brothers. Thought that my mother was black, which we never really tried to say one way or another. We lived in a mixed neighborhood. Who cares? I mean, which, you know, my mother has darker skin, so she is in all respects. So, but I could, you hear it in the voice. It's like in the idea that when a person is white and you hear, jokes or disparaging remarks about with race, and they think that you're not part of that. So that was something that that was part of my life. And so my mother's last words to me was, she said, when I see God, I'm going to ask him what this skin color thing is all about.
So something that really haunted her her whole life.
Well, I think race is probably the... I think race is one of the most important issues and anxieties that face our country, and I wish that I could really deal with that.
Did she go to your performances?
Oh, yeah, she went to my performances. She would say to me, Karen, I think you have to wait till you get to menopause. And then you'll really understand what female sexuality is about.
That was my 2002 conversation with controversial performance artist Karen Finley. A 25th anniversary edition of her first book, Shock Treatment, has just been published. This is Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear the story of the SS United States, which will be moving from its 20-year-long stint in South Philadelphia to sail around the world once again. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Back in the 1950s, a sturdy ocean liner called the SS United States made news because of its remarkable speed. At that time, it was a favorite of the rich and famous and everyday travelers who boarded the ship in New York to sail to Europe. Since its heyday, it's been rusting away, docked in South Philadelphia, a relic of American history. But it looks like it will have a new life. Crystal Cruises announced this week that the 2,000-passenger liner will be updated and set sail once again. A few years ago, we learned about the history of the SS United States from Susan Gibbs, granddaughter of the ship's designer, and Stephen Ujifusa, author of a book called A Man and His Ship, America's Greatest Naval Architect and His Quest to Build the SS United States. Let's listen. Stephen, what's so great about the SS United States?
I think the SS United States is losing the SS United States would be like losing Penn Station the way we did in the 1960s. Something that we in Philadelphia take for granted. We drive past it. People don't notice it. And then people learn the history of it. The amount of pure effort and talent and genius that went into this ship is a real testament to the American spirit of the 1940s and 50s. And in many ways, the SS United States is a total work of art. She is a blend of engineering, of aesthetics, of interior design. All these things came in together into an entity that could float and carry 2,000 or 3,000 people in safety. So it's a complex balancing act creating an ocean liner like that, and not like today's cruise ships, which are built for warm water, tranquil travel. But this is a ship meant to battle the North Atlantic. And not only was she supposed to be strong and fast, but she was also supposed to be beautiful. And William Francis Gibbs, when he designed this ship, in addition to making her a luxury liner that could be turned into a troop ship should war break out, he also made her into a aesthetically magnificent ship, which you don't see anymore. And he was, in many ways, in love with his creation.
Well, and is the inside still intact? I mean, I've seen photographs of what it was like to travel and to enjoy the lounges and the rooms there. Are they still intact, Susan?
No. She's basically been stripped out again by a previous owner. But the good news about that, there is a silver lining, is that all of the asbestos that was once on board, because my grandfather was a maniac for fire safety, fire prevention, and so the ship was laden with it. It is all gone. And so the interiors actually offer this blank canvas, perfect opportunity for redevelopment.
Gibbs is a fascinating guy. He has some roots here in Philadelphia. It seems like even as a young person, obsessed with boats. Would you say, though, he was in many ways a self-taught architect? He did go to, Harvard for a while, but then had to drop out, I think, for financial reasons.
He did. And in many ways, I got to look at his transcripts in the Harvard archives.
Oh,
and it
yeah?
was funny because his engineering grades, he started off at the engineering school and they were not that good.
Like, what were they?
They were full on fail.
Yeah, they were terrible.
Okay, they were terrible.
He was
flunked out of Harvard.
Okay,
we can
tell the truth here. He can handle it.
Yeah, he also, but he ended up being not as, in many ways, like a Steve Jobs character, and that he was a man who was a real genius, came to organization, motivating, and he could supervise and hire very talented subordinates and then drive them towards an ideal. So in many ways, he was that sort of figure.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to look at the construction of this ship and what Gibbs's thinking was. For one thing, he didn't want wood or very much wood in this ship. And why was that?
Gibbs was following Navy regulations at the time in terms of fireproofing, but he also was absolutely fanatical when it came to fire prevention. There have been a number of very disastrous passenger ship fires in the first half of the 20th century. And so when Gibbs, his criteria for the construction of the ship was he looked at all the record-breaking European liners that had been built before, as well as smaller passenger ships he'd worked on and on all the Navy ships he'd built during World War II, and basically melded them into one sort of synthesis in terms of design and construction. So in terms of safety, his criteria was this ship must survive the same damage that sank the Titanic in 1912, and he set pen to paper really in 1945, right after World War II ended, and he was basically given a sort of tentative thumbs up to start designing an American superliner. So the Titanic, which sank in 1912, she could float with only two of her first 16 of her 16 watertight compartments flooded, or the first four, while that iceberg ripped open the first six,
exactly.
And she sank. So Gibbs said in his design, for a slightly larger ship, she was slightly larger than the Titanic, this ship would have 20 watertight compartments, and she could float with any five of them flooded. And that is a standard which has yet to have been surpassed. And he also said, in order for this ship to be fast, I'm going to take the aluminum, which was extensively used in his World War II ships, and use that for the upper decks to save weight. And not only that, take engines that have been perfected during World War II for battleships and put them into the SS United States, giving her much, much more power than the Queen Mary or any other European liners.
So if we were to go on board the SS United States, would we see just lots of aluminum everywhere from what is left
mm-hmm.
inside?
Yeah, you certainly would. And it looks as if it was put on yesterday. And, you know, my grandfather liked to say, you can't set her on fire, you can't catch her, and you can't sink her. You know, he was very proud of his handiwork.
Mainly he was thinking from perspective of having the ship also serve as a troop ship, because in order for the United States Lines, which is the company that we operate, to get the funding to build it, they would need an extensive subsidy from the Navy, and this ship would be turned into a troop transport should war break out. So that's the primary reason why she was so overbuilt compared to previous liners, was that she was actually a warship in disguise.
And paid for in part by the U.S. government.
In large part by the U.S. government.
Right.
And she could be converted within very short order from a passenger ship able to carry 2,000 passengers in three classes and 1,000 crew into a troop ship able to carry 15,000 soldiers or an entire army division.
Wow.
10,000 miles without refueling, which was something that all the other European ships which had been used as troop ships during the Second World War couldn't do.
Did you ever ride on or travel the Atlantic on the SS?
Unfortunately, I did not. I did not. The first time I was aboard the ship was here in Philadelphia in 2001.
How about for you, Stephen? I don't know how old you are.
You're probably
too young, right?
I'm too young. I've never traveled on the ship. My grandparents traveled on the ship in the early 60s, so that's how I first heard about it.
Well, we have someone who did travel on the SS United States. We have Mike from Swarthmore who wants to join our conversation. Let me get Mike on the air. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi Marty. I worked on the SS United States during the summer of 1967 when I was a graduate. It's during the summer when I was in graduate school. And it was, for me, a wonderful break from classes, and it was just a thrilling experience.
What were the what were the conditions like, I guess, for people that worked on the ship, Mike?
Well, that's what's so interesting. When you go on the ship, the people on the passenger side don't know that when you walk through these innocuous-looking doors, all of a sudden you're in the middle of the ship where the crew is and where all of the work goes on behind the scenes. And the conditions were very good. I was in a room, and there were six bunks. There were six of us, and we worked. The shifts were unusual. We worked 3 hours on, 3 hours off, or something close to that, because the ship changed time zones so quickly that was about the only way you could keep the things staffed, at least on the part of the ship I was on. I was a bellboy going across the Atlantic, and you'd wind up moving the clock ahead 90 minutes every day.
Oh, that's interesting. Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Stephen, anything you want to add to that? I know you interviewed people who worked on this ship.
That was the most satisfying part of writing the book, was talking to all the people whose lives have been touched by this ship. And the ship was a big deal back then, whether they worked on the ship or traveled on the ship. If you said, I'm working on the SS United States, or I'm going to Europe on the SS United States, that was a big deal. And one of the appeals of the ship was the secrecy of her top speed, because it was a government-classified statistic. No one was supposed to know. No one was supposed to know the power of the engines. She did hit 36 knots on her maiden voyage, and she did 34 knots on the return from Europe to America. But it was hinted that she still has plenty of power in reserve.
Wow.
So that's incredibly fast. And basically, these are engines that were later used in the Forrestal-class aircraft carrier. And unlike a typical ship, if you were on the Queen Mary or the Ile de France and you're a passenger, oh, I want to see the engine room. Sure, no big deal. Take a look. Not on the SS United States. Not allowed.
Top secret. That's something like 44 miles an hour. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Her top speed was 38 and a half, which is about 44 land miles an hour.
Yeah. Did you want to add to that? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty darn fast, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And through probably rough seas at times?
The North Atlantic is not like a typical pleasure cruise. It is, in most seasons, very bad. You either get fog, you get storms. It's only during a brief interlude during the summer where you can expect fairly calm weather. And the SS United States, even though she is 3 football fields long, she would roll like most big liners in this weather. And she would not slow down. Unlike other ships, when they'd hit a storm, they'd often reduce speed. The SS United States, unless it was a hurricane, she kept barreling along at 30 knots.
Susan, tell us about some of the, I guess, famous people that were on the SS United States, went across the Atlantic Ocean.
One could speak at length about,
indeed,
there was a very long list, really all the who's who of the 50s and 60s traveled aboard the ship, from 4 U.S. presidents to Marilyn Monroe to Bob Hope, movie stars, moguls, it's how people went back and forth to Europe. So it an extraordinary array of high-profile individuals.
Stephen, you include some photographs in here, including one of Salvador Dali on the SS United States, in the first class, I should say.
Yes, and I have to really thank Joe Rota, who was on the board of the SS United States Conservancy. I interviewed him extensively, and he was also a ship's photographer. And he was gracious enough to provide me a number of photographs from his collection. And Salvador Dali, a story I heard from another crew member I interviewed, Bill Krudner, was that Bill Krudner had served Salvador Dali as one of his stewards, and towards the end of the crossing, Salvador Dali is sitting in a deck chair, doodling away, you know, looking at the Atlantic, you know, with his, you know, spiky mustache.
Right.
Bill Krudner walks by, and Salvador Dali says, "Bill, please come here." And he says, "Here, this is for you." And Salvador Dali had given Bill Krudner, a little sketch, a little surrealist sketch showing the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty reaching across the Atlantic and shaking hands. So Bill says, thank you, and he goes back to his cabin, and he's in a rush, so he puts it on his desk and then runs out. He comes back a few minutes later, and it's gone. And Bill said, I could have retired off of that sketch.
Do we know where it is?
I don't know.
Hanging on someone's wall somewhere.
Perhaps someone will call in.
But these are the sorts of stories, the sorts of people you'd run into on the ship, whether you are traveling on the SS United States as a passenger or if you're working as a crew member. And as Joe once told me, some of them are great and some of them were not so nice.
Yeah, exactly. In the ship's heyday, you could get a really good meal, or I guess really good breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the SS United States.
The menus that survive from this ship's 17 years of service are pretty incredible. Looking at the maiden voyage especially, they went all out. They had a German-born chef with the name Otto Bismarck, no relation to the Iron Chancellor, who basically could create the finest menus, finest creations, and he ordered only the best produce while in port. And that was one of the appeals of these ships, is that they were destinations in themselves back in the 50s and early 60s. People would choose the ship as a place, as a sort of cultural destination. Oh, do you want to be on a French ship? Do you want to be an American ship? And the SS United States' main attraction was that she was extremely fast. She would always get you there on time. And a lot of people commented she was also kept a lot cleaner than the European ships. She was immaculate. As one crew member told me, she was kept so clean you could eat off the floors. And just the level of service in all three classes is something that's very hard to recapture today. Mm-hmm. And this was a time when you did dress for dinner. And you see pictures of passengers traveling on the ship and people were wearing jackets and ties. It was a much more formal era, and it was also an era where you could not be reached on your iPhone, so you pretty much were left alone for 4.5 days to read or eat or play deck games, and you didn't have the mass entertainments and Broadway shows on board. You had a dance orchestra that was very in each of the three classes. You had a well-stocked library, but very different from today's cruise ships.
Indeed. I'm just trying to imagine, even on a very seaworthy ship like the SS United States, to be in the middle of a storm / hurricane and the waves and the wind, of course, is sort of overwhelming. Susan, your thought?
Well, just on the yes, absolutely overwhelming, and but also just the international star appeal of this ship. Your caller mentioned the exchange program, and even now the Conservancy has members from, I think it's 25 countries now. We just had our first member from Abu Dhabi last week.
Maybe they have some money.
we've been unabashed in terms of our describing this as America's flagship. It really embodies so powerfully the America's can-do spirit, technological innovation. It really represents the very best of this nation. However, it also again has this far-reaching global following, and of course, what did it do in its seagoing service career but connect this country to the rest of the world? And so its symbolism and its global reach and power really is never ceases to amaze me.
That was my 2014 conversation with Susan Gibbs and Stephen Ujifusa about the SS United States. The once great transatlantic passenger ship will be great once again. It was just announced that it will be updated and set sail around the world. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us, and have a great snack-filled Super Bowl weekend.